Welcome to East Meets West, episode 217. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Jank.
And joining us is Brian Brushwood. You might know
him America.
From Scam School or NSFW Show or shows across the country in various auditoria.
Yeah, the live shows. And don't forget the Weird Things podcast. That's my new favorite project that I'm doing.
We just had Andrew Main on Forecast last week.
How did he do? Did he pass the test?
Oh, yeah, he did great. In fact, we were having some Skype troubles with our other guest, and he helped sort of carry the water a little bit when we needed to make it through some tough periods when we're trying to reconnect and everything, and he was awesome.
Do you declare a winner at the end of Forecast?
No, the winner is the audience, Brian.
Not anymore. I say you declare a winner, and you shame the other guy.
Future generations who gain the wisdom of our guests.
Do you go back and revisit like old forecasts to when the predictions were for like this current year?
No, because we never get any predictions for the current year. Everybody's always like safely far ahead. I think we've had
I was on it and I gave you your prediction.
First time that anybody gave it like a really near term prediction. But there is a guy who has a forecast website out there where he's tracking all the predictions.
Does he have money?
We should create a forecast timeline of all the predictions of all the guests.
I like that.
Well, and then it's like, by now, flying cars invented. Robots take over universe.
Didn't I do one for the end of the year for midterms?
What was it? I can't remember them all. I apologize.
It was like the Democrats would lose control of the House.
Oh, yeah. So there we go. You'll be the first testable forecast prediction.
Yes.
We can start a spinoff called Forecast Follow-Up.
That's going to be a very it's going to be a very intermittent show.
It'll come out every 15 years, something like that.
It'll be like a high school reunion, except less enjoyable because you don't get to see everyone slowly get fat and bald.
That's your prediction for the future. We get fat, we get bald, then we die.
The singularity is near, but not fast enough for us.
Well, hey, have you ever been to your high school reunion?
Oh, my God. I've never made it to one of them, but I have a feeling what I would see.
I went to my 10-year, and there was a little bit of weight gain here and there. And then there were, you know, a few women who had not been very popular in high school who had, you know, come into their own and came back all hotted up trying to, you know, show somebody what's happening.
Were they the ones you used to make fun of in high school?
I never made fun of anybody. Are you kidding? I was on the butt end of that, Roger. You know that.
A butt end. Well, it's interesting. I went to my high school 10-year high school reunion, and I remember there was this one girl. I'm not gonna say her name, but damn, she looked exactly the same. She was just as hot now as she was back in high school, except that she was pulling around a less attractive guy than she was dating back in high school.
Alien.
But, hey,
turns out it was the same guy.
No.
He was fat and bald
at the time. Unless he shrunk, lost hair, got glasses in the decade after graduation. What was also interesting was one of the class clowns I used to remember from high school ended up being a vice principal for one of the local high schools. And I thought that was just very, very not ironic, but you know, maybe it is ironic.
Yeah, it's irony when somebody who hates the man becomes the man. That's irony.
Yeah, So.
I thought irony was when you say something, but you actually mean the opposite.
Technically, irony is 10,000 spoons when what you need is a knife.
The irony of that situation. How many spoons have I wasted needing a knife? I'll tell you. Why are we so fascinated with high school, though, right? And or whatever the equivalent is in your country. Is it just that sort of...
It's the United States.
Sorry?
You know why? Is because you know...
Wait. It's a question to the broad audience. I'm sorry. I thought you were directing it at me.
Yes, I know you think everything's about you, Roger, but sometimes it's not.
It is. In the end, you'll find out it is.
We're all just existing in Roger Chang's dream.
I watched Inception. I know what happens.
Spoilers!
By the way, I'm wrestling with that. Like, the whole reason that we are so infatuated with our graduating class is because this is... For most of us, the group of people that we spent our lives growing up with, and now this is a break, and we're all going to go in different directions for the rest of our lives. But it's like, with my 6-year-old, she's having a tough time in kindergarten, and I'm really looking forward to there's an opportunity. We're going to go on a trip, and I'm going to take her out of school for a couple of months. We're going to homeschool her for a couple of years, and I'm kind of into that. And I'm really questioning what's so great about having my daughter raised by my neighbor's kids. Does that make sense?
You mean like going to a public school?
Yeah, yeah. I'm kind of down on the whole, like, you know, everyone's in the same club together, you know?
The value is supposed to be that you have experts in education, not raising them, but helping them to learn so that the pressure isn't all on you because you aren't an expert in everything. So you have someone who's an expert, not just in the topics, but in the ability to get kids to learn where you might get frustrated and, you know, you haven't been trained. I'm not sure that it works that way. Of course, the cynics in the audience are immediately going to go, well, that never happens. It does actually happen sometimes in schools, but it doesn't happen all the time. So right. I think that's why a lot of people are tempted to homeschool, because they look at the system or they look at the schools that are available to them, at least that they can afford, and they say, you know what, I can do just as well as that, whether they can or not. I think in a lot of cases, probably they can. But it's you know, it's that question where you're like, why would I send them into this arena where they have to where they're subjected to so much negativity and probably don't learn the things that they should learn?
I don't know. I mean, there is a social aspect to it where it's interesting that Brian brought up the word raising. I mean, I think it's only maybe in the past two decades where people think of school as somewhere where as an institution that actually raises and rears your child instead of just, you know, teaching them or training them in a particular skill, where we've essentially kind of, you know, not everyone, but maybe in popular thought that school is where you leave your kids to do the other 50% of their growing up. And I think high school is such an important aspect, because it's kind of where I think people decide that's the transition period, because most people are 18 generally when they graduate, and that kind of signals adulthood. So you have this transitory period between, you know, okay, now I'm growing up, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, I finally become an adult, granted, a, you know, still relatively new adult, but I've made that kind of transitory hump between what used to be my childhood and now my future. And I think people look back on that when they go to a reunion. Sorry, I'm kind of shuffling off a little bit here, because it's such an important moment. It's such a, you know, it's such a pivotal point in their life. And they, you know, we all do that. We kind of set it as the primary benchmark in our life. So we finish high school. That's that one big chunk of our life, and then we move forward, and then, you know, after college, our first job, and then marriage, and what other kind of milestones that we put to mark, you know, the growth or at least the passing of time in our lives. And I think high school is just because, you know, people remember it. It's I was a kid, but at the end of it, I had to, you know, at least for most people, I had to kind of get a job, go to college, do all these things that I didn't used to have to do because my parents took care of it. But now I'm on my own.
Well, wait, here's the thing. The number one and number two responses I hear, and like, why not homeschool? The number one response, and I understand that logistically, is some people need to work and they need their kids to be somewhere else being taken care of during that time. Totally get that. Some people say, well, I don't have the time to teach my kid. If you're at home, you have the time. Like, we, since we're planning ahead for this homeschooling period, there is less than an hour of actual lesson learning during an entire day of school. The rest of the time is all, you know, getting in lines and walking over here and eating your lunches and playing on the playground or whatever. The other thing that I hear, and I've seen it in the chat room here a whole bunch, is, oh, you got to socialize your kids. But think about this environment of socialization. You get a whole bunch of kids of the same age, put them in a room together, and make the whole experience about obeying somebody in charge. That never, ever happens in real life. That never happens again outside of school. There's never a time in any of our lives that we all deal with a bunch of people all the same age and do what we're told. And what is so great about that experience, you know?
Well, you know, it's – I don't know. I think part of it is – I think you're looking at strictly from the classroom setting and not so much from the kind of social connections that students build up with each other in and outside of class. Yeah, you can make an argument either way, and – my position on the whole thing is it depends on the parent, depends on the child, and depends on the school. Those are the three variables. You can't say it's a blanket rule that fits, you know, everyone to a T. For some people whose situation, you know, doesn't allow it, they can't homeschool, they send their kids to what they think would be the best place to educate their child and have the positive, or at least what they think are the positive role models that, you know, they'll encounter. You know, I've known parents who've taken kids out of school because they think it's too violent, the amount of bullying that goes on, and they think it's not conducive to their child's psychological health. And, you know, they pull them out, and because they can't afford private school, they go into homeschooling. But it's interesting. They'll usually it'll be a parent, but the parent will either take time off work or they'll just leave work entirely, and they'll have to rearrange their finances, but they make it work. But I, you know, it's interesting. I think you bring up a valid point, Brian. It's like, you know, there are reasons against, but I also think that there are reasons for. And again, depending on the child, depending on the parent, depending on the school, the situation, you know, it can always go one way or the other. You can't say that it's always going to be, you know, one exact experience for everyone.
Well, and I tell you, you know, and I'll be honest, part of this is personal for us is because, you know, Penelope, my 6-year-old, is very good at being very upset when she sees injustice. And she got in trouble a lot in kindergarten. And the reason she got in trouble is because when somebody would steal something from another person, she would melt down and explode on that person. And because of the way somebody has to logistically run an elementary school, Penelope was the one to get in trouble. And it's like, that's a bunch of BS. Yeah. That's horse apples.
It is. I mean, I spent the first 6 months in sixth grade being in the principal's office because I would get into fights that I did not initiate, but because I was involved in it, I was deemed somehow a troubled, you know, student, when it turned out that I was just in the wrong classes and I tended to be on the small side. So I was just, you know, I was a very obvious target for a lot of kids to pick on.
Right. I was just going to say, like, in the chat room, people are saying, Brian got to teach kids to follow the system, obey the rules. Unfortunately, I've built my whole career on not doing that. And that's something important to me, is that you question authority and that you do what's right for everyone. And I'm running into how incompatible that is with a public employee whose job is to satisfy 30 different masters by taking care of their kids. And it's very frustrating. And it's like, for the first time, I'm like, man, I really wish I was making enough money that I could just hire a private tutor for an hour a day, teach my kids everything.
Have you ever been to private school or a parochial school?
I did. When we lived in Norway for a year and a half, I went to private school, and several of my friends, after I graduated college, taught in private school. And I was like, well, how did you teach in private school? You don't have a teaching certificate. He's like, you don't need a teaching certificate for private school. It's private. They pick the, you know, whoever's good at teaching. They don't worry about certificates. And it's like, all of that really is breaking my mind. It's like, it either makes me want to look into private school or look into homeschooling, and that's messing me up.
Let's go back to the socialization aspect for a second, because I think, Brian, you touched on a lot of the problems with saying, well, public school or even private school socializes. There are a lot of ways you can socialize your kid in homeschool. In fact, I know I've talked to a lot of people who homeschool, who have homeschool groups where they get together with other parents who do homeschooling just for that kind of hanging out, learning to deal with other kids. And so I think that's an important part, is that you can do a lot of what they get in school on your own. It's a question of whether you afford that opportunity. Again, it's just harder to homeschool.
It's harder.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Good.
No, I just said yes so that you could talk. Okay. go ahead.
Well, no, I was just saying, like, you know, I mean, that argument can also – an argument can also be made that parents will tend to self-segregate either consciously or unconsciously about the kids they – you know, the kids are exposed to. And
that's,
you know,
good, by the way. That's what I want to do. I want to actively segregate my kid from the bullies who keep taking her objects away from her.
But isn't that a good lesson to learn how to stick up for yourself?
No, not when she does stick up for herself and ends up being punished by the institution because it's inconvenient for the class.
So you need to bring in your own bullies into a homeschooling situation under
a trained bully.
What do we do? We're all adults now, and there are people who try to bully us. And what do? We decide that guy's a dick, and we go somewhere else. In school, you don't get to do that. The most realistic way to handle it is not an option.
And also, I have to say, you know, this idea of, like, I hear this argument sometimes, and I'm not actually arguing against public schools. I think there's a lot of good things about public schools, but I think this argument that people make, well, they learn a lot of life lessons by having to go through public school. It's like, well, great. Why don't we also send them to live in projects, too, if they don't already? They'll learn a ton of life lessons.
A war. They got to learn how to fight a war sooner.
Exactly. It's like, no, that's not how you teach them. That's not a good way. I think the big negative from homeschooling versus I don't want to say public school or private school. I'm going to lump them both together here. An institutional school is that, again, all of the pressure is on the parent to provide all of the expertise. And I think your idea of like having a tutor come in isn't a bad one. But, you know, sending them to an institution is a good idea in theory, but in practice, it ends up being what you're talking about, which is really just a bureaucracy. It usually doesn't have a person with a vision behind it that can make it the experience it's supposed to be, because all the teachers are just trying to fill out their paperwork and get through and get their salary as best that they can. They do care about the kids, but they aren't rewarded for caring about the kids.
So, I mean,
teachers deserve a lot of love because they care about the kids anyway. But there's nothing pushing them to do that because the system just wants them to move the kids through.
But I would have to say that I would disagree with your lumping of private and public schools together.
Well, I was just doing that for the sake of argument because of homeschool versus a building. But yeah, there are differences. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say that in my experience, because I spent 5 years at a Catholic school and then moved on to public school, and I've said this many times, is that I actually learned more. I adjusted socially much better because, first of all, the classrooms were a lot smaller. But a lot of the rules that public schools run by sometimes don't apply in a private school because they are, if your parent doesn't like it, they're just going to yank the kid out and not pay tuition. But the learning environment was much, much better. I would say I was at least two grades ahead. Like by the time I came out of fifth grade, out of the Catholic school, I should have been in seventh grade in public school where they stuck me. And, you know, there are a lot of arguments, but I really think it just comes down to when you have a situation where you have more students than you have teachers, you have resources, you have money, all that, you basically end up with what, you know, at least in California, the school system ends up being is that you have, you know, breakdown in social cohesion, you have breakdown in authority. And what happens is everyone just is kind of defaults into a bureaucratic mode because, you know, they just want to get through the day and they're going to do their job to the letter of whatever it needs to be. And then they'll go, because when you try caring, when you try doing, you know, for teachers, I know a couple of teachers who worked in public schools and then transferred out to private institutions. You can't do anything because there's this huge bureaucracy. You can't change the lessons plans. You can't do the kind of things that you want to do because it's not allowed or you don't have the money. I know one teacher was for half a year was actually supplying all the materials for a class, papers, writing implements, you know, things like that, that the school should have been taken care of, but didn't have the budget for. And, you know, it's essentially, you know, we have a broken, or at least in the state of California, we have a broken school system that
it's not
is either
the state of California. I think what you're saying.
Well, I'm only speaking from my experience, so I'm not going to speak outside of it. Where you're essentially, you know, we spend a lot of money in schools, and I'm not sure exactly where the money is going. If it's going actually to the teachers, or is it going through administrators?
And the evidence seems to be that it's going to the teachers because there's no shortage. In fact, there is oftentimes 1,000 applicants for every one teaching job that becomes available. But keep in mind, the whole reason I brought this question up is because in practicing for the brief amount of homeschooling we're going to do, I was shocked that Penelope, in order to follow the curriculum for a first grader, needs to do, I think, 4 pages of work per day, which she's able to do in an hour. And I thought just as it started off as a nutty thought experiment where it's like, what if Penelope was able to keep growing and learning at exactly the same rate as all the other kids, but learn how to socialize with adults who weren't going to steal her candy and push her around and do all the idiotic things that kids who have parents who don't raise their children well do. And I got to admit, I didn't see her growing up as a terrible sheltered person. I saw her growing up to be us.
Well, what about friends? What about making lifelong friends or having companions that understand what you're going through because it's the same sort of age? What do you do to fill that gap?
That you and Roger are going to be lifelong friends with me. And we didn't meet because we happen to be in the same class.
True. Okay. Fair enough. But I'm just saying, like, there's an element to being a kid. I mean, I don't think what you're saying is this. I don't think you're saying that kids can grow up without having any other kids their own age as friends and be just fine.
No, yeah. I'm not. Yeah. Well, you know what?
So how do you mix that in and stick with your vision? Because I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with it, but like, what do you do for that aspect of stuff?
There are 4-year-olds who are mature as 5-year-olds, and there are 6-year-olds as immature as a 5-year-old, and they would be a great match, and they don't happen to be the same age. Right. This idiotic notion that we need to raise kids in batches based on their birth date is completely asinine, and it's unhelpful for moving ahead.
So where do you find those kids that forget about age that are going to be those companions?
The internet. There are support groups where you interact with other people. There's, you know, my daughter goes horseback riding. She does tap dance. She does swimming lessons. She goes to computer camp. She does mad science. She does all the things and experiences the world as it actually exists, not in some idiotic construct that exists only in our public school system.
So it sounds like we got Brian making the argument, really good argument, for why homeschooling is pretty awesome if you have the time. But then for the people who don't have the time, who just don't have the money or the resources or the luxury of being able to homeschool all the time, Roger is kind of saying, you know, private school is the better option. Does that mean that vouchers are the best way?
Well, I don't want to get political. I mean, which I don't know if we're already being political.
Well, you're already political.
I know that's a political hot button, but I am personally, let me put it this way. I certainly wish vouchers were available in my county with a 6-year-old and a yen to put her into a private school, but without the money.
I think where our school system, I think Brian touched on it, is that we've kind of turned public school systems into this kind of huge factory where one size fits all. And I agree that there are situations where, you know, maybe more magnet schools or specialized schools would help, but where you can kind of funnel kids into areas that they're interested in, whether it's the arts, sciences, academia, or what have you. And, I think voucher. I am actually kind of pro voucher. Having looked into it a little bit, I know several. You know, it's not a new concept. It's been used. Sweden uses it for their school system, and I think it could work. However, the education system in many states is a bureaucracy. I mean, it's like any other government agency, that there's a unwillingness to change or adapt because things have been done in a certain way, a certain fashion for so long that to do, you know, anything else outside of that would be tantamount to kind of, you know, destroying the system as it was meant to be, you know, run. And I think that, you know, to Brian's point that, you know, yeah, vouchers would be great if we kind of, you know, gave parents the option to say, you know, hey, my daughter or my son should go into an all art school, or they should go into an all engineering school, where you can kind of pair up their interest in the interest of their classmates to a particular avenue, instead of trying to force kind of feed them into one giant generic, you know, one giant generic bureaucratic school where you basically have to teach the same thing to the same kids day in and day out, regardless of whether or not it's something that they'll use, something they're interested in, or something that's helpful.
So here's another idea. In some European countries, what they do is they tie the money. It's the same amount of dollars. Like, the way we do it is we have a certain amount of dollars per student that is, and we gerrymander everything. Everything's divvied up by location. If you happen to live in this neighborhood, you have to go to this school. And what you end up with is very precise, similar social demographics and backgrounds going to the exact same school. In places like Amsterdam, they tie the money to the student. And it's total free choice. You can go to a private school. You can go to a public school. It doesn't matter. The money's tied to your student. And as a result, schools have to compete. And the way they compete is, say, you know, 30% of our students got into Harvard. Well, guess which high school I'm sending my kid to? And it makes it to where they are accountable. And instead, It seems like over the last 10 years, there's been an explosion of saying, well, schools are underfunded. They're underfunded. There are schools who have doubled and tripled and quadrupled their budgets, and everybody's making more money. And yet the graduation rates are the same. The test scores are the same. You know, what would be wrong with allowing free choice to enter where we get to send our kids for school?
I don't disagree with you.
All right. Well, let's before we wrap up here, let's move on to one user comment off of the blog at subbrilliant.com/EMW. This is Greg Kramer. Because he spells it differently in the chat room. Your speculation about the benefits of geeking out and the higher level of engagement that comes with it reminds me of a book I'm surprised more tech folks haven't read, Steven Johnson's Everything Bad is Good for You, the central point of which is this. TV, movies, and games are challenging us in new ways that are making us more intelligent and actually creating new forms of intelligence that aren't measured by traditional tests. And it is these new intelligences that will be critical to the current trajectory of human evolution.
So is he saying that watching TV, movies, and playing video games is good for you?
Yes, that it seems to be what he's saying.
I can see television being good as long as it's something that is engaging, and then you will have you can have a discussion or discourse with friends, like we do, like with Doctor Who, whatever. After the show's over, we talk about it. But if it's something where that person is a shut-in, that's all they do, and that I don't think that would benefit them at all, because I think the stimulation occurs watching and then kind of analyzing what they've just watched with someone else to bounce ideas off, to kind of come to different points of view that they might not necessarily have or share.
Well, so what you're saying is the tool can be used improperly.
Yes, it is a tool, but it can either be a beneficial one or one that can be not used in a beneficial way and therefore actually make things worse.
What do you think about this, Brian?
I'm not going to lie. I've spent the last 30 seconds engaged in a debate on the chat room defending my positions. The question is that everything bad is good for you is the precept. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. The rough idea is last week's show. We talked about how geeking out is a good thing. And it's like geeking out about TVs, movies, and entertainment, just as cool as geeking out about food or geeking out about sports. It's a thing that shows your passion and gets you going and actually leads you to make connections and think in new ways. And Kramer on the blog here said there's the book called Everything Bad is Good for You, which has that fact that TV, movies, and games are challenging us in new ways that make us more intelligent and actually create new forms of intelligence.
Absolutely. I'm not going to lie. My kid loves TV, but I look at her and she totally veges out. She engages so fully in it that she's just totally switched off, and I hate it. And I'm actively trying to get her into video games. She loves to sit and watch me play video games. She loves the story and the interaction and the excitement, but she doesn't want to engage herself. And I'm actually trying to get her. I would much rather her play video games for 3 hours a day than watch TV for 1 hour a day.
I wonder though, and I'm not disagreeing with Roger that watching too much TV can be bad, but really, how often is it that bad? How many people actually do watch too much TV to their detriment? I think that Steven Johnson in this book makes a good point, which is it forces us to think. Even when we're watching crappy TV, we think about it. We analyze it. We think in new ways. So maybe it is actually something that can be positive in a lot more ways than we think. And I think the reaction of TV is junk, TV is bad, it makes you sit there slack-jawed and you're not engaging, is because we, as the people not watching TV, who see the people who are left out. It's quite possible that reaction comes from the selfish need to be engaged with the other person when they're engaged with the television, and you're not interested in that show, or you're not watching it, or you're sort of left out.
Here's what I worry about. Go ahead, Roger. I'm sorry.
I never said that. I think I didn't say too much TV was bad. I think TV without just watching it and doing nothing else with it. I mean, I think you're making a point that, you can only judge if you actually do a questionnaire, you talk to the person about whether or not they're actively engaged or thinking about it. They could just as well be zoning out. They could just be, totally in a stupor.
Sure. They could be shitting their pants, too. I mean, you could make up all kinds of things. But we know that most of the time that's not what happens. Most of the time people are.
Well, how do we know? But that's my point, is how do we know?
How do we know anything? That's my point. I mean, that's a solipsism.
Well, No. What I'm saying is, how do you measure it? I mean, you're basically casting out. You're casting out. You know, what is fact? What could be fact or what could not be? Because we can't have
any kind of a legitimate debate if we don't agree on a few facts. So, do you disagree that when people watch TV, most of the time they're paying attention, or do you think that that's a totally unknown and we can't make that assumption?
I would say that's a total unknown.
All right. Well, that's the end of the show then.
Sorry, Tom. I disagree because
we're throwing you all off. But Cuba.
Cuba.
I turn on the TV when I'm doing laundry. I don't necessarily pay attention. I just like listening to it.
Doesn't mean
I follow what's going on or I know someone's name on it. All I know is there's a bunch of voices talking off in the living room as I'm loading the washer and clearing out the dryer.
I think you're diverting.
That doesn't mean I'm gauged.
I think you're diverting.
If you're saying that people are sitting there watching specific shows and they're watching it from beginning to end because of the story, yeah, okay, they're engaged. But if someone's just sitting in front of the TV, I'm not necessarily going to say that they're totally in tune. They're totally understanding what's going on.
But you're picking on a small part of the argument and undermining it without paying any attention to the rest of the argument, which is, do you think that in the cases where people are watching TV and paying attention, that they are actually gaining some benefit?
That's a loaded question. You just said if people are watching TV and paying attention, that How is that a loaded question?
Because you didn't even let me finish the question.
Well, the original question was, you know, people watching TV, is it good or bad? And I said, depending on what they're doing with it.
No. I'm moving the conversation on somewhere else, which is, you know, maybe our reaction to them thinking that it's bad when we watch that person is because they won't interact with us.
Maybe. I don't think so.
I like this Roger Honestly. Chang. This is the Roger Chang I missed. This is the Roger Chang I started doing East Meets West with. I'm happy you're back, Roger.
I'm sorry. I totally disagree. I mean, what do you want me to say? Wrong, Tom. Absolutely, critically wrong. TV's nothing but a giant wasteland. I read in a book somewhere. Nothing but commercials and biased opinions and, you know, entertainment masquerading as news, scantily clad women, obese people appearing to be normal people. No, I don't think so.
All right.
Drug driving school education. That's what we want the future for our kids? No.
I think all education should be done over television. I think it is the only medium worth watching. No, I don't think that at all. But
I will say though, like as much as aesthetically, it's very disturbing to watch your kid totally zone out watching TV. I have to kind of fight with the missus because she grew up in the country with only one channel. She only got like PBS and CBS, and that's it. And then those are the two channels, but let's face it, PBS was not a channel in the early 1980s.
What are you talking about? I was raised by PBS.
She can't handle the idea of Penny watching television. But meanwhile, I always felt bad for the kid who didn't know that theme song we were all singing on the bus. You know, and it's like that's part of if we're going to raise our kids in crops, you might as well feed them the same thing all the other kids are getting so that they could be in on the jokes and culturally aware.
You mean be part of the group, be part of the
get with the system, stand in line. Mass. March forward in formation.
Respect authority.
If you don't know the theme song to Different Strokes, then you're an outcast, a social outcast.
Yes. All right, folks. If you like, or more importantly, if you dislike what we're saying on the show, you can express your opinions at sabrilliant.com/EMW in the comments. We do read them all. Sometimes we read some on the show. Brian Brushwood, thank you very much for jumping in. This was great. Excellent insight.
Sorry I derailed it. You didn't get to talk about Doctor Who. Tom Baker was the best.
You know,
it
Brian,
was a good finale. People should watch it.
If we had rails on this show, maybe you could feel bad, but there's no roads. There's no rails.
Where we're going, we don't need rails.
Let the fine folks know where else they can find you on the internet.
I'm serious. I don't know why, but it's like I've recently like really wanted to up my little Twitter count. And somehow maybe it's because I only have the population of some never heard of town before in Arizona.
I'm Gloucester, Massachusetts myself.
At SHWOOD, there's only two things I try to do. I don't fill you with minutia. I only announce when I'm going live or when you can see my content, and then and either try to spoon feed you stuff I think is awesome or try to share a witticism.
All right, twitter.com/Schwood. Of course, you can follow television producer Roger Chang at twitter.com/JollyRoger.
Yes, two L's.
He doesn't like the drug, but he likes to push it.
What are you talking about? I enjoy my product.
don't sample your own product, though. That's one of the rules. All right.
Is it? Oh, damn.
Subbrilliant.com/EFW. We'll see you later, folks.
Watch the wire, Tom.